I think it would. But the capital would still be in control of Panem as well. Cheese sandwiches are passed around, and we eat them in the shade of the trees. I intentionally sit at the far edge of the group next to Pollux, so I don't have to talk. No one's talking much, really. In the relative quiet, the birds take back the woods. I nudge Pollux with my elbow and point out a small black bird with a crown. It hops to a new branch, momentarily opening its wings, showing off its white patches. Pollux gestures to my pin and raises his eyebrows questioningly. I nod, confirming it's a mockingjay. I hold up one finger to say, "Wait, I'll show you," and whistle a bird call. The mockingjay cocks its head and whistles the call right back at me. Then, to my surprise, Pollux whistles a few notes of his own. The bird answers him immediately. Pollux's face breaks into an expression of delight, and he has a series of melodic exchanges with the mockingjay. My guess is it's the first conversation he's had in years. Music draws mockingjays like blossoms do bees, and in a short while he's got half a dozen of them perched in the branches over our heads. He taps me on the arm and uses a twig to write a word in the dirt. Sing? Usually I'd decline, but it's kind of impossible to say no to Pollux, given the circumstances. Besides, the mockingjay's song voices are different from their whistles, and I'd like him to hear them. So before I actually think about what I'm doing, I sing Rue's four notes, the ones she used to signal the end of the workday in 11, the notes that ended up as the background music to her murder. The birds don't know that. They pick up the simple phrase and bounce it back and forth between them in sweet harmony, just as they did in the Hunger Games before the mutations broke through the trees, chased us onto the cornucopia, and slowly gnawed Cato to a bloody pulp. "Want to hear them do a real song?" I burst out. Anything to stop those memories. I'm on my feet, moving back into the trees, resting my hand on the rough trunk of a maple where the birds perch. I have not sung The Hanging Tree out loud for 10 years, because it's forbidden, but I remember every word. I begin softly, sweetly, as my father did. Are you coming to the tree where they strung up a man, they say murdered three? Strange things did happen here, no stranger would it be if we met up at midnight in the hanging tree. The mockingjays begin to alter their songs as they become aware of my new offering. Are you coming to the tree where the dead man called out for his love to flee? Strange things did happen here, no stranger would it be if we met up at midnight in the hanging tree. I have the birds' attention now. In one more verse, surely they will have captured the melody, as it's simple and repeats four times with little variation. Are you coming to the tree where I told you to run so we'd both be free? Strange things did happen here, no stranger would it be if we met up at midnight in the hanging tree. A hush in the trees, just the rustle of leaves in the breeze, but no birds, mockingjay or other. Peter's right. They do fall silent when I sing, just as they did for my father. Are you coming to the tree where a necklace of rope side by side with me? Strange things did happen here, no stranger would it be if we met up at midnight in the hanging tree. The birds are waiting for me to continue, but that's it. Last verse. In the stillness, I remember the scene. I was home from a day in the woods with my father, sitting on the floor with Prim, who was just a toddler, singing The Hanging Tree. Making us necklaces out of scraps of old rope, like it said in the song, not knowing the real meaning of the words. The tune was simple and easy to harmonize to, though, and back then I could memorize almost anything set to music after a round or two. Suddenly, My mother snatched the rope necklaces away and was yelling at my father. I started to cry because my mother never yelled, and then Prim was wailing and I ran outside to hide. As I had exactly one hiding spot, in the meadow under a honeysuckle bush, my father found me immediately. He calmed me down and told me everything was fine. Only we'd better not sing that song anymore. My mother just wanted me to forget it. So, of course, every word was immediately, irrevocably branded into my brain. We didn't sing it anymore, my father and me, or even speak of it. After he died, it used to come back to me a lot. Being older, I began to understand the lyrics. At the beginning, it sounds like a guy is trying to get his girlfriend to secretly meet up with him at midnight. But it's an odd place for a tryst, a hanging tree, where a man was hung for murder. The murderer's lover must have had something to do with the killing, or maybe they were just going to punish her anyway, because his corpse called out for her to flee. That's weird, obviously, the talking corpse bit, but it's not until the third verse that the hanging tree begins to get unnerving. You realize the singer of the song is the dead murderer. He's still in the hanging tree, and even though he told his lover to flee, he keeps asking if she's coming to meet him. The phrase, "where I told you to run so we'd both be free," is the most troubling, because at first you think he's talking about when he told her to flee, presumably to safety. But then you wonder if he meant for her to run to him, to death. In the final stanza, it's clear that that's what he's waiting for. His lover, with her rope necklace, hanging dead next to him in the tree. I used to think the murderer was the creepiest guy imaginable. Now, with a couple of trips to the Hunger Games under my belt, I decide not to judge him without knowing more details. Maybe his lover was already sentenced to death and he was trying to make it easier, to let her know he'd be waiting. Or maybe he thought the place he was leaving her was really worse than death. Didn't I want to kill Peeta with that syringe to save him from the capital? Was that really my only option? Probably not, but I couldn't think of another at the time. I guess my mother thought the whole thing was too twisted for a 7-year-old, though, especially one who made her own rope necklaces. It wasn't like hanging was something that only happened in a story. Plenty of people were executed that way in 12. You can bet she didn't want me singing it in front of my music class. She probably wouldn't like me doing it here for Pollux, even. But at least I'm not. Wait. No, I'm wrong. As I glance sideways, I see Castor has been taping me. Everyone is watching me intently, and Pollux has tears running down his cheeks because no doubt my freaky song has dredged up some terrible incident in his life. Great, I sigh and lean back against the trunk. That's when the mockingjays begin their rendition of the hanging tree. In their mouths, it's quite beautiful. Conscious of being filmed, I stand quietly until I hear Cressida call, "Cut!" Plutarch crosses to me, laughing.
"Where do you come up with this stuff? No one would believe it if we made it up."
He throws an arm around me and kisses me on the top of my head with a loud smack.
"You're golden!"
"I wasn't doing it for the cameras," I say.
"Lucky they were on, then," he says. "Come on, everybody, back to town."
As we trudge back through the woods, we reach a boulder, and both Gail and I turn our heads in the same direction, like a pair of dogs catching a scent on the wind. Cressida notices and asks what lies that way. We admit, without acknowledging each other, it's our old hunting rendezvous place. She wants to see it, even after we tell her it's nothing, really. Nothing but a place where I was happy, I think. Our rock ledge overlooking the valley, perhaps a little less green than usual, but the blackberry bushes hang heavy with fruit. Here began countless days of hunting and snaring, fishing, and gathering, roaming together through the woods, unloading our thoughts while we filled our game bags. This was the doorway to both sustenance and sanity, and we were each other's key. There's no District 12 to escape from now, no peacekeepers to trick, no hungry mouths to feed. The Capitol took away all of that, and I'm on the verge of losing Gale as well. The glue of mutual need that bonded us so tightly together for all those years is melting away. Dark patches, not light, show in the spaces between us. How can it be that today, in the face of 12's horrible demise, we are too angry to even speak to each other? Gale as good as lied to me. That was unacceptable, even if he was concerned about my well-being. His apology seemed genuine, though, and I threw it back in his face with an insult to make sure it stung. What is happening to us? Why are we always at odds now? It's all a muddle. But I somehow feel that if I went back to the root of our troubles, my actions would be at the heart of it. Do I really want to drive him away? My fingers encircle a blackberry and pluck it from its stem. I roll it gently between my thumb and forefinger. Suddenly, I turn to him and toss it in his direction. "And may the odds," I say. I throw it high, so he has plenty of time to decide whether to knock it aside or accept it. Gale's eyes train on me, not the berry. But at the last moment, he opens his mouth and catches it. He chews, swallows, and there's a long pause before he says, "Be ever in your favor." But he does say it. Cressida has a sit in the nook in the rocks, where it's impossible not to be touching, and coaxes us into talking about hunting. What drove us out into the woods, how we met, favorite moments. We thaw, begin to laugh a little, as we relate mishaps with bees and wild dogs and skunks. When the conversation turns to how it felt to translate our skill with weapons to the bombing in 8, I stop talking. Gale just says, "Long overdue." By the time we reach the town square, afternoon's sinking into evening. I take Cressida to the rubble of the bakery and ask her to film something. The only emotion I can muster is exhaustion. "Peter, this is your home. None of your family has been heard of since the bombing. 12 is gone. And you're calling for a ceasefire?" I look across the emptiness. "There's no one left to hear you." As we stand before the lump of metal that was the gallows, Cressida asks if either of us has ever been tortured. In answer, Gale pulls off his shirt and turns his back to the camera. I stare at the lash marks and again hear the whistling of the whip, see his bloody figure hanging unconscious by his wrists. "I'm done," I announce. "I'll meet you at the Victor's Village. Something for my mother." I guess I walked here, but the next thing I'm conscious of is sitting on the floor in front of the kitchen cabinets of our house in the Victor's Village, meticulously lining ceramic jars and glass bottles into a box, placing clean cotton bandages between them to prevent breaking, wrapping bunches of dried flowers. Suddenly I remember the rose on my dresser. Was it real? If so, is it still up there? I have to resist the temptation to check. If it's there, it will only frighten me all over again. I hurry with my packing. When the cabinet's empty, I rise to find that Gale has materialized in my kitchen. It's disturbing how soundlessly he can appear. He's leaning on the table, his fingers spread wide against the wood grain. I set the box between us. "Remember," he asks, "this is where you kissed me." So the heavy dose of morphling administered after the whipping wasn't enough to erase that from his consciousness. "I didn't think you'd remember that," I say.
"Have to be dead to forget. Maybe not even then," he tells me.
Maybe I'll be like that man in the hanging tree, still waiting for an answer.
Gale, who I have never seen cry, has tears in his eyes. To keep them from spilling over, I reach forward and press my lips against his. We taste of heat, ashes, and misery. It's a surprising flavor for such a gentle kiss. He pulls away first and gives me a wry smile.
I knew you'd kiss me.
How? I say, because I didn't know myself.
Because I'm in pain, he says. That's the only way I get your attention.
He picks up the box.
Don't worry, Katniss. It'll pass.
He leaves before I can answer. I'm too weary to work through his latest charge. I spend the short ride back to 13 curled up in a seat, trying to ignore Plutarch going on about one of his favorite subjects, weapons mankind no longer has at its disposal. High-flying planes, military satellites, cell disintegrators, drones, biological weapons with expiration dates, brought down by the destruction of the atmosphere or lack of technological resources or moral squeamishness. You can hear the regret of a head game maker who can only dream of such toys, who must make do with hovercraft and land-to-land missiles and plain old guns. After dropping off my Mockingjay suit, I go straight to bed without eating. Even so, Prim has to shake me to get me up in the morning. After breakfast, I ignore my schedule and take a nap in the supply closet. When I come to, crawling out from between the boxes of chalk and pencils, it's dinner time again. I get an extra large portion of pea soup and am headed back to compartment E when Boggs intercepts me.
There's a meeting in command. Disregard your current schedule, he says.
Done, I say.
Did you follow it at all today? He asks in exasperation.
Who knows? I'm mentally disoriented. I hold up my wrist to show my medical bracelet and realize it's gone. See? I can't even remember they took my bracelet. Why do they want me in command? Did I miss something?
I think Cressida wants to show you the 12 propos, but I guess you'll see them when they air, he says.
That's what I need a schedule of, when the propos air, I say. He shoots me a look, but doesn't comment further. People have crowded into command, but they've saved me a seat between Finnick and Plutarch. The screens are already up on the table, showing the regular capital feed.
What's going on? Aren't we seeing the 12 propos? I ask.
Oh, no, says Plutarch. I mean, possibly. I don't know exactly what footage Beatty plans to use.
Beatty thinks he's found a way to break into the feed nationwide, says Finnick, so that our propos will air in the capital, too. He's down working on it in special defense now. There's live programming tonight. Snow's making an appearance or something. I think it's starting.
The capital seal appears, underscored by the anthem. Then I'm staring directly into President Snow's snake eyes as he greets the nation. He seems barricaded behind his podium, but the white rose on his lapel is in full view. The camera pulls back to include Peeta off to one side in front of a projected map of Panem. He's sitting in an elevated chair, his shoes supported by a metal rung. The foot of his prosthetic leg taps out a strange, irregular beat. Beads of sweat have broken through the layer of powder on his upper lip and forehead. But it's the look in his eyes, angry yet unfocused, that frightens me the most.
He's worse, I whisper.
Finnick grasps my hand to give me an anchor, and I try to hang on. Peeta begins to speak in a frustrated tone about the need for the ceasefire. He highlights the damage done to key infrastructure in various districts, and as he speaks, parts of the map light up, showing images of the destruction, a broken dam in 7, a derailed train with a pool of toxic waste spilling from the tank cars, a granary collapsing after a fire. All of these he attributes to rebel action. Bam! Without warning, I'm suddenly on television, standing in the rubble of the bakery. Plutarch jumps to his feet.
He did it! Beatty broke in!
The room's buzzing with reaction when Peter's back, distracted. He has seen me on the monitor. He tries to pick up his speech by moving on to the bombing of a water purification plant, when a clip of Finnick talking about Rue replaces him. And then the whole thing breaks down into a broadcast battle, as the Capitol tech masters try to fend off Beatty's attack. But they are unprepared, and Beatty, apparently anticipating he would not hold on to control, has an arsenal of 5 to 10 second clips to work with. We watch the official presentation deteriorate as it's peppered with choice shots from the propos. Plutarch's in spasms of delight, and most everybody is cheering Beatty on, but Finnick remains still and speechless beside me. I meet Haymitch's eyes from across the room and see my own dread mirrored back. The recognition that with every cheer, Peter slips even farther from our grasp. The Capitol seals back up, accompanied by a flat audio tone. This lasts about 20 seconds before Snow and Peter return. The set is in turmoil. We're hearing frantic exchanges from their booth. Snow plows forward, saying that clearly the rebels are now attempting to disrupt the dissemination of information they find incriminating. But both truth and justice will reign. The full broadcast will resume when security has been reinstated. He asks Peter if, given tonight's demonstration, he has any parting thoughts for Katniss Everdeen. At the mention of my name, Peter's face contorts in effort.
Katniss, how do you think this will end? What will be left? No one is safe, not in the capital, not in the districts. And you, in 13.
He inhales sharply, as if fighting for air. His eyes look insane.
Dead by morning.
Off camera, Snow orders.
End it.
Beatty throws the whole thing into chaos by flashing a still shot of me standing in front of the hospital at 3-second intervals. But between the images, we are privy to the real-life action being played out on the set. Peter's attempt to continue speaking, the camera knocked down to record the white-tiled floor, the scuffle of boots, the impact of the blow that's inseparable from Peter's cry of pain, and his blood as it splatters the tiles. Part 2. The Assault. Chapter 10. The scream begins in my lower back and works its way up through my body, only to jam in my throat. I'm an AVOX mute, choking on my grief. Even if I could release the muscles in my neck, let the sound tear into space, would anyone notice it? The room's in an uproar. Questions and demands ring out as they try to decipher Peter's words.
And you, in 13, dead by morning.
Yet no one is asking about the messenger whose blood has been replaced by static. A voice calls the others to attention.
Shut up!
Every pair of eyes falls on Haymitch.
It's not some big mystery. The boy's telling us we're about to be attacked. Here, in 13.
How would he have that information?
Why should we trust him? How do you know?
Haymitch gives a growl of frustration.
They're beating him bloody while we speak. What more do you need? Katniss, help me out here.
I have to give myself a shake to free my words. Haymitch is right. I don't know where Peter got the information or if it's true, but he believes it is, and there... I can't say aloud what Snow's doing to him.
You don't know him,
Haymitch says to Coyne.
We do. Get your people ready.
The president doesn't seem alarmed, only somewhat perplexed by this turn in events. She mulls over the words, tapping one finger lightly on the rim of the control board in front of her. When she speaks, she addresses Haymitch in an even voice. Of course, we have prepared for such a scenario, although we have decades of support for the assumption that further direct attacks on 13 would be counterproductive to the capital's cause. Nuclear missiles would release radiation into the atmosphere, with incalculable environmental results. Even routine bombing could badly damage our military compound, which we know they hope to regain. And of course, they invite a counterstrike. It is conceivable that, given our current alliance with the rebels, those would be viewed as acceptable risks.
You think so? Says Haymitch.
It's a shade too sincere, but the subtleties of irony are often wasted in 13.
I do, at any rate. We're overdue for a level 5 security drill, says Coyne. Let's proceed with the lockdown.
She begins to type rapidly on her keyboard, authorizing her decision. The moment she raises her head, it begins. There have been 2 low-level drills since I arrived in 13. I don't remember much about the first. I was in intensive care in the hospital, and I think the patients were exempted, as the complications of removing us for a practice drill outweighed the benefits. I was vaguely aware of a mechanical voice instructing people to congregate in yellow zones. During the second, a level 2 drill meant for minor crises, such as a temporary quarantine while citizens were tested for contagion during a flu outbreak, we were supposed to return to our living quarters. I stayed behind a pipe in the laundry room, ignored the pulsating beeps coming over the audio system, and watched a spider construct a web. Neither experience has prepared me for the wordless, eardrum-piercing, fear-inducing sirens that now permeate 13. There would be no disregarding this sound, which seems designed to throw the whole population into a frenzy. But this is 13, and that doesn't happen. Boggs guides Finnick and me out of command, along the hall to a doorway and onto a wide stairway. Streams of people are converging to form a river that flows only downward. No one shrieks or tries to push ahead. Even the children don't resist. We descend, flight after flight, speechless, because no word could be heard above this sound. I look for my mother and Prim, but it's impossible to see anyone but those immediately around me. They're both working in the hospital tonight, though, so there's no way they can miss the drill. My ears pop and my eyes feel heavy. We are coal mine deep. The only plus is that the farther we retreat into the earth, the less shrill the sirens become. It's as if they were meant to physically drive us away from the surface, which I suppose they are. Groups of people begin to peel off into marked doorways, and still Boggs directs me downward, until finally the stairs end, at the edge of an enormous cavern. I start to walk straight in, and Boggs stops me, shows me that I must wave my schedule in front of a scanner so that I'm accounted for. No doubt the information's going to some computer somewhere to make sure no one's gone astray. The place seems unable to decide if it's natural or man-made. Certain areas of the walls are stone, while steel beams and concrete heavily reinforce others. Sleeping bunks are hewn right into the rock walls. There's a kitchen, bathrooms, a first aid station. This place was designed for an extended stay. White signs with letters or numbers are placed at intervals around the cavern. As Boggs tells Finnick and me to report to the area that matches our assigned quarters, in my case E for compartment E, Plutarch strolls up.
Ah, here you are, he says.
Recent events have had little effect on Plutarch's mood. He still has a happy glow from Beatty's success on the airtime assault, eyes on the forest, not on the trees.
not on PETA's punishment or 13's imminent blasting.
Katniss, obviously this is a bad moment for you, what with PETA's setback, but you need to be aware that others will be watching you.
What? I say. I can't believe he actually just downgraded PETA's dire circumstances to a setback.
The other people in the bunker, they'll be taking their cue on how to react from you. If you're calm and brave, others will try to be as well. If you panic, it could spread like wildfire, explains Plutarch.
I just stare at him.
Fire is catching, so to speak, he continues,
as if I'm being slow on the uptake.
Why don't I just pretend I'm on camera, Plutarch? I say.
Yes, perfect. One is always much braver with an audience, he says. Look at the courage PETA just displayed.
It's all I can do not to slap him.
I've got to get back to COIN before lockdown. You keep up the good work, he says, and then heads off.
I cross to the big letter E posted on the wall. Our space consists of a 12-by-12-foot square of stone floor, delineated by painted lines. Carved into the wall are two bunks. One of us will be sleeping on the floor, and a ground-level cube space for storage. A piece of white paper, coated in clear plastic, reads, Bunker Protocol. I stare fixedly at the little black specks on the sheet. For a while, they're obscured by the residual blood droplets that I can't seem to wipe from my vision. Slowly, the words come into focus. The first section is entitled, On Arrival. 1. Make sure all members of your compartment are accounted for. My mother and Prim haven't arrived, but I was one of the first people to reach the bunker. Both of them are probably helping to relocate hospital patients. 2. Go to the supply station and secure one pack for each member of your compartment. Ready your living area? Return pack or packs. I scan the cavern until I locate the supply station. A deep room set off by a counter. People wait behind it, but there's not a lot of activity there yet. I walk over, give our compartment letter, and request 3 packs. A man checks a sheet, pulls the specified packs from shelving, and swings them up onto the counter. After sliding one on my back and getting a grip on the other two with my hands, I turn to find a group rapidly forming behind me. Excuse me, I say as I carry my supplies through the others. Is it a matter of timing, or is Plutarch right? Are these people modeling their behavior on mine?
Back at our space, I open one of the packs to find a thin mattress, bedding, 2 sets of gray clothing, a toothbrush, a comb, and a flashlight. On examining the contents of the other packs, I find the only discernible difference is that they contain both gray and white outfits. The latter will be for my mother and Prim, in case they have medical duties. After I make up the beds, store the clothes, and return the backpacks, I've got nothing to do but observe the last rule. 3. Await further instructions. I sit cross-legged on the floor to await. A steady flow of people begins to fill the room, claiming spaces, collecting supplies. It won't take long until the place is full up. I wonder if my mother and Prim are going to stay the night at wherever the hospital patients have been taken. But no, I don't think so. They were on the list here. I'm starting to get anxious when my mother appears. I look behind her into a sea of strangers. Where's Prim? I ask.
Isn't she here? She replies. She was supposed to come straight down from the hospital. She left 10 minutes before I did. Where is she? Where could she have gone?
I squeeze my lids shut tight for a moment to track her as I would prey on a hunt. See her react to the sirens, rush to help the patients, nod as they gesture for her to descend to the bunker, and then hesitate with her on the stairs. Torn for a moment. But why? My eyes fly open. The cat! She went back for him!
Oh, no!
my mother says. We both know I'm right. We're pushing against the incoming tide, trying to get out of the bunker. Up ahead, I can see them preparing to shut the thick metal doors, slowly rotating the metal wheels on either side inward. Somehow I know that once they have been sealed, nothing in the world will convince the soldiers to open them. Perhaps it will even be beyond their control. I'm indiscriminately shoving people aside as I shout for them to wait. The space between the doors shrinks to a yard, a foot. There are only a few inches left when I jam my hand through the crack. "Open it! Let me out!" I cry. Consternation shows on the soldiers' faces as they reverse the wheels a bit, not enough to let me pass, but enough to avoid crushing my fingers. I take the opportunity to wedge my shoulder into the opening. "Prim!" I holler up the stairs. My mother pleads with the guards as I try to wriggle my way out. "Prim!" Then I hear it, the faint sound of footsteps on the stairs. "We're coming!" I hear my sister call. "Hold the door!" That was Gale. "They're coming," I tell the guards, and they slide the doors open about a foot. But I don't dare move, afraid they'll lock us all out, until Prim appears, her cheeks flushed with running, hauling Buttercup. I pull her inside, and Gale follows, twisting an armload of baggage sideways to get it into the bunker. The doors are closed with a loud and final clank. "What were you thinking?" I give Prim an angry shake and then hug her, squashing Buttercup between us. Prim's explanation is already on her lips.
"I couldn't leave him behind, Katniss, not twice. You should have seen him pacing the room and howling. He'd come back to protect us."
"Okay, okay." I take a few breaths to calm myself, step back, and lift Buttercup by the scruff of the neck. "I should have drowned you when I had the chance." His ears flatten, and he raises a paw. I hiss before he gets a chance, which seems to annoy him a little, since he considers hissing his own personal sound of contempt. In retaliation, he gives a helpless kitten mew that brings my sister immediately to his defense.
"Oh, Katniss, don't tease him," she says, folding him back in her arms. "He's already so upset."
The idea that I've wounded the brute's tiny cat feelings just invites further taunting. But Prim's genuinely distressed for him. So instead, I visualize Buttercup's fur lining a pair of gloves, an image that has helped me deal with him over the years. "Okay, sorry. We're under the big E on the wall. Better get him settled in before he loses it." Prim hurries off, and I find myself face to face with Gale. He's holding the box of medical supplies from our kitchen in 12. Sight of our last conversation. Kiss, fallout. Whatever. My game bags slung across his shoulder. "If PETA's right, these didn't stand a chance," he says. PETA, blood like raindrops on the window, like wet mud on boots. "Thanks for everything." I take our stuff. "What were you doing up in our rooms?"
"Just double-checking," he says.
"We're in 47 if you need me." Practically everyone withdrew to their spaces when the doors shut, so I get to cross to our new home with at least 500 people watching me. I try to appear extra calm, to make up for my frantic crashing through the crowd. Like that's fooling anyone, so much for setting an example. Oh, who cares? They all think I'm nuts anyway. One man, who I think I knocked to the floor, catches my eye and rubs his elbow resentfully. I almost hiss at him, too. Prim has Buttercup installed on the lower bunk, draped in a blanket so that only his face pokes out. This is how he likes to be when there's thunder, the one thing that actually frightens him. My mother puts her box carefully in the cube. I crouch, my back supported by the wall, to check what Gale managed to rescue in my hunting bag. The plant book, the hunting jacket, my parents' wedding photo, and the personal contents of my drawer.
My Mockingjay pin now lives with Cinna's outfit, but there's the gold locket and the silver parachute with the spile, and Peeta's pearl. I knot it in the corner of the parachute, bury it deep in the recesses of the bag, as if it's Peeta's life and no one can take it away as long as I guard it. The faint sound of the sirens cut off sharply. Coyne's voice comes over the district audio system, thanking us all for an exemplary evacuation of the upper levels. She stresses that this is not a drill, as Peeta Mellark, the District 12 victor, has possibly made a televised reference to an attack on 13 tonight. That's when the first bomb hits. There's an initial sense of impact, followed by an explosion that resonates in my innermost parts. The lining of my intestines, the marrow of my bones, the roots of my teeth. We're all going to die, I think. My eyes turn upward, expecting to see giant cracks race across the ceiling, massive chunks of stone raining down on us. But the bunker itself gives only a slight shudder. The lights go out, and I experience the disorientation of total darkness, speechless human sounds, spontaneous shrieks, ragged breaths, baby whimpers, one musical bit of insane laughter dance around in the charged air. Then there's a hum of a generator, and a dim wavering glow replaces the stark lighting that is the norm in 13. It's closer to what we had in our homes in 12, when the candles and fire burned low on a winter's night. I reach for Prim in the twilight, clamp my hand on her leg, and pull myself over to her. Her voice remains steady as she croons to Buttercup. "It's all right, baby. It's all right. We'll be okay down here." My mother wraps her arms around us. I allow myself to feel young for a moment and rest my head on her shoulder. "That was nothing like the bombs in 8, I say. "Probably a bunker missile," says Prim, keeping her voice soothing for the cat's sake. "We learned about them during the orientation for new citizens. They're designed to penetrate deep in the ground before they go off, because there's no point in bombing 13 on the surface anymore." "Nuclear?" I ask, feeling a chill run through me.
"Not necessarily," says Prim. "Some just have a lot of explosives in them. But it could be either kind, I guess."
The gloom makes it hard to see the heavy metal doors at the end of the bunker. Would they be any protection against a nuclear attack? And even if they were 100% effective at sealing out the radiation, which is really unlikely, would we ever be able to leave this place? The thought of spending whatever remains of my life in this stone vault horrifies me. I want to run madly for the door and demand to be released into whatever lies above. It's pointless. They would never let me out. And I might start some kind of stampede. "We're so far down, I'm sure we're safe," says my mother wanly. Is she thinking of my father's being blown to nothingness in the mines? "It was a close call, though. Thank goodness Peeta had the wherewithal to warn us." The wherewithal, a general term that somehow includes everything that was needed for him to sound the alarm. The knowledge, the opportunity, the courage, and something else I can't define. Peeta seemed to have been waging a sort of battle in his mind, fighting to get the message out. Why? The ease with which he manipulates words is his greatest talent. Was his difficulty a result of his torture? Something more? Like madness? Coyne's voice, perhaps a shade grimmer, fills the bunker, the volume level flickering with the lights. "Apparently, Peeta Mellark's information was sound, and we owe him a great debt of gratitude. Sensors indicate the first missile was not nuclear, but very powerful. We expect more will follow. For the duration of the attack, citizens are to stay in their assigned areas unless otherwise notified." A soldier alerts my mother that she's needed in the first aid station. She's reluctant to leave us, even though she'll only be 30 yards away.
We'll be fine, really, I tell her.
Do you think anything could get past him?
I point to Buttercup, who gives me such a half-hearted hiss. We all have to laugh a little. Even I feel sorry for him. After my mother goes, I suggest,
"Why don't you climb in with him, Prim?"
I know, it's silly, but I'm afraid the bunk might collapse on us during the attack, she says.
If the bunks collapse, the whole bunker will have given way and buried us, but I decide this kind of logic won't actually be helpful. Instead, I clean out the storage cube and make Buttercup a bed inside. Then I pull a mattress in front of it for me and my sister to share. We're given clearance in small groups to use the bathroom and brush our teeth, although showering has been canceled for the day. I curl up with Prim on the mattress, double-layering the blankets because the cavern emits a dank chill. Buttercup, miserable even with Prim's constant attention, huddles in the cube and exhales cat breath in my face. Despite the disagreeable conditions, I'm glad to have time with my sister. My extreme preoccupation since I came here, no, since the first games, really, has left little attention for her. I haven't been watching over her the way I should, the way I used to. After all, it was Gale who checked our compartment, not me. Something to make up for. I realize I've never even bothered to ask her about how she's handling the shock of coming here.
So how are you liking 13, Prim? I offer.
Right now?
She asks. We both laugh.
I miss home badly sometimes, but then I remember there's nothing left to miss anymore. I feel safer here. We don't have to worry about you. Well, not the same way.
She pauses, and then a shy smile crosses her lips.
I think they're going to train me to be a doctor.
It's the first I've heard of it.
Well, of course they are. They'd be stupid not to. They've been watching me when I help out in the hospital. I'm already taking the medic courses. It's just beginner stuff. I know a lot of it from home. Still, there's plenty to learn, she tells me.
That's great, I say. Prim, a doctor. She couldn't even dream of it in 12. Something small and quiet, like a match being struck, lights up the gloom inside me. This is the sort of future a rebellion could bring.
What about you, Katniss? How are you managing?
Her fingertip moves in short, gentle strokes between Buttercup's eyes.
And don't say you're fine.
It's true. Whatever the opposite of fine is, that's what I am.
So I go ahead and tell her about Peeta, his deterioration on screen, and how I think they must be killing him at this very moment. Buttercup has to rely on himself for a while, because now Prim turns her attention to me, pulling me closer, brushing the hair back behind my ears with her fingers. I've stopped talking because there's really nothing left to say, and there's this piercing sort of pain where my heart is. Maybe I'm even having a heart attack, but it doesn't seem worth mentioning.
Katniss, I don't think President Snow will kill Peeta, she says.
Of course she says this. It's what she thinks will calm me. But her next words come as a surprise.
If he does, he won't have anyone left you want. He won't have any way to hurt you.
Suddenly I am reminded of another girl, one who had seen all the evil the capital had to offer. Joanna Mason, the tribute from District 7 in the last arena. I was trying to prevent her from going into the jungle where the Jabberjays mimicked the voices of loved ones being tortured. But she brushed me off, saying,
"They can't hurt me. I'm not like the rest of you. There's no one left I love."
Then I know Prim is right, that Snow cannot afford to waste Peeta's life, especially now, while the Mockingjay causes so much havoc. He's killed Cinna already, destroyed my home, My family, Gale, and even Haymitch, are out of his reach. Peter's all he has left.
So what do you think they'll do to him? I ask.
Prim sounds about 1,000 years old when she speaks.
Whatever it takes to break you.
Chapter 11.
What will break me?
This is the question that consumes me over the next 3 days as we wait to be released from our prison of safety. What will break me into 1,000,000 pieces so that I am beyond repair, beyond usefulness? I mention it to no one, but it devours my waking hours and weaves itself throughout my nightmares. 4 more bunker missiles fall over this period. All massive, all very damaging, but there's no urgency to the attack. The bombs are spread out over the long hours so that just when you think the raid is over, another blast sends shockwaves through your guts. It feels more designed to keep us in lockdown than to decimate 13. Cripple the district, yes. Give the people plenty to do to get the place running again. But destroy it? No. Coyne was right on that point. You don't destroy what you want to acquire in the future. I assume what they really want in the short term is to stop the airtime assaults and keep me off the televisions of Panem. We receive next to no information as to what is happening. Our screens never come on, and we get only brief audio updates from Coyne about the nature of the bombs. Certainly, the war is still being waged. But as to its status, we're in the dark. Inside the bunker, cooperation is the order of the day. We adhere to a strict schedule for meals and bathing, exercise, and sleep. Small periods of socialization are granted to alleviate the tedium. Our space becomes very popular because both children and adults have a fascination with Buttercup. He attains celebrity status with his evening game of Crazy Cat. I created this by accident a few years ago during a winter blackout. You simply wiggle a flashlight beam around on the floor, and Buttercup tries to catch it. I'm petty enough to enjoy it because I think it makes him look stupid. Inexplicably, everyone here thinks he's clever and delightful. I'm even issued a special set of batteries, an enormous waste, to be used for this purpose. The citizens of 13 are truly starved for entertainment. It's on the third night, during our game, that I answer the question eating away at me. Crazy Cat becomes a metaphor for my situation. I am Buttercup. Peeta, the thing I want so badly to secure, is the light. As long as Buttercup feels he has the chance of catching the elusive light under his paws, he's bristling with aggression. That's how I've been since I left the arena, with Peeta alive. When the light goes out completely, Buttercup's temporarily distraught and confused, but he recovers and moves on to other things. That's what would happen if Peeta died. But the one thing that sends Buttercup into a tailspin is when I leave the light on, but put it hopelessly out of his reach, high on the wall, beyond even his jumping skills. He paces below the wall, wails, and can't be comforted or distracted. He's useless until I shut the light off. That's what Snow is trying to do to me now, only I don't know what form his game takes. Maybe this realization on my part is all Snow needs. Thinking that Peeta was in his possession and being tortured for rebel information was bad, but thinking that he's being tortured specifically to incapacitate me is unendurable. And it's under the weight of this revelation that I truly begin to break. After Crazy Cat, we're directed to bed. The power's been coming and going. Sometimes the lamps burn at full brightness. Other times we squint at one another in the brownouts. At bedtime, they turn the lamps to near darkness and activate safety lights in each space. Prim, who's decided the walls will hold up, snuggles with Buttercup on the lower bunk. My mother's on the upper. I offer to take a bunk, but they make me keep to the floor mattress, since I flail around so much when I'm sleeping. I'm not flailing now, as my muscles are rigid with the tension of holding myself together. The pain over my heart returns, and from it I imagine tiny fissures spreading out into my body. Through my torso, down my arms and legs, over my face, leaving it crisscrossed with cracks. One good jolt of a bunker missile, and I could shatter into strange, razor-sharp shards. When the restless, wiggling majority has settled into sleep, I carefully extricate myself from my blanket and tiptoe through the cavern until I find Finnick, feeling for some unspecified reason that he will understand. He sits under the safety light in his space, knotting his rope, not even pretending to rest. As I whisper my discovery of Snow's plan to break me, it dawns on me. This strategy is very old news to Finnick. It's what broke him. This is what they're doing to you with Annie, isn't it? I ask. Well, they didn't arrest her because they thought she'd be a wealth of rebel information, he says. They know I'd never have risked telling her anything like that, for her own protection. Oh, Finnick, I'm so sorry, I say. No, I'm sorry that I didn't warn you somehow, he tells me. Suddenly, a memory surfaces. I'm strapped to my bed, mad with rage and grief after the rescue. Finnick is trying to console me about Peeta. They'll figure out he doesn't know anything pretty fast, and they won't kill him if they think they can use him against you. You did warn me, though, on the hovercraft. Only when you said they'd use Peeta against me, I thought you meant like bait, to lure me into the capital somehow, I say. I shouldn't have said even that. It was too late for it to be of any help to you. Since I hadn't warned you before the quarter quell, I should have shut up about how Snow operates. Finnick yanks on the end of his rope, and an intricate knot becomes a straight line again. It's just that I didn't understand when I met you. After your first games, I thought the whole romance was an act on your part. We all expected you'd continue that strategy, but it wasn't until Peeta hit the force field and nearly died that I... Finnick hesitates. I think back to the arena. How I sobbed when Finnick revived Peeta, the quizzical look on Finnick's face, the way he excused my behavior, blaming it on my pretend pregnancy. That you what? That I knew I'd misjudged you. That you do love him. I'm not saying in what way. Maybe you don't know yourself, but anyone paying attention could see how much you care about him, he says gently. Anyone? On Snow's visit before the victory tour, he challenged me to erase any doubts of my love for Peeta.
Convince me, Snow said.
It seems, under that hot pink sky with Peeta's life in limbo, I finally did. And in doing so, I gave him the weapon he needed to break me. Finnick and I sit for a long time in silence, watching the knots bloom and vanish, before I can ask, how do you bear it? Finnick looks at me in disbelief. I don't, Katniss. Obviously, I don't. I drag myself out of nightmares each morning and find there's no relief in waking. Something in my expression stops him. Better not to give in to it. It takes 10 times as long to put yourself back together as it does to fall apart. Well, he must know. I take a deep breath, forcing myself back into one piece. The more you can distract yourself, the better, he says. First thing tomorrow, we'll get you your own rope. Until then, take mine. I spend the rest of the night on my mattress obsessively making knots, holding them up for Buttercup's inspection. If one looks suspicious, he swipes it out of the air and bites it a few times to make sure it's dead. By morning, my fingers are sore, but I'm still holding on.
With 24 hours of quiet behind us, Coyne finally announces we can leave the bunker. Our old quarters have been destroyed by the bombings. Everyone must follow exact directions to their new compartments. We clean our spaces, as directed, and file obediently toward the door. Before I'm halfway there, Boggs appears and pulls me from the line. He signals for Gale and Finnick to join us. People move aside to let us by. Some even smile at me, since the crazy cat game seems to have made me more lovable. Out the door, up the stairs, down the hall to one of those multi-directional elevators, and finally we arrive at Special Defense. Nothing along our route has been damaged, but we are still very deep. Boggs ushers us into a room virtually identical to Command. Coyne, Plutarch, Haymitch, and Cressida, and everybody else around the table looks exhausted. Someone has finally broken out the coffee, although I'm sure it's viewed only as an emergency stimulant. And Plutarch has both hands wrapped tightly around his cup, as if at any moment it might be taken away. There's no small talk. "We need all four of you suited up and above ground," says the president. "You have 2 hours to get footage showing the damage from the bombing. Establish that 13's military unit remains not only functional, but dominant, and most important, that the Mockingjay is still alive. Any questions?"
"Can we have a coffee?" asks Finnick.
Steaming cups are handed out. I stare distastefully at the shiny black liquid, never having been much of a fan of the stuff, but thinking it might help me stay on my feet. Finnick sloshes some cream in my cup and reaches into the sugar bowl.
"Want a sugar cube?"
he asks, in his old seductive voice. That's how we met, with Finnick offering me sugar. Surrounded by horses and chariots, costumed and painted for the crowds. Before we were allies, before I had any idea what made him tick. The memory actually coaxes a smile out of me.
"Here, it improves the taste," he says, in his real voice, plunking 3 cubes in my cup.
As I turn to go suit up as the Mockingjay, I catch Gale watching me and Finnick unhappily.
"What now? Does he actually think something's going on between us?
Maybe he saw me go to Phoenix last night. I would have passed the Hawthorne space to get there. I guess that probably rubbed him the wrong way, me seeking out Phoenix's company instead of his. Well, fine. I've got rope burn on my fingers, I can barely hold my eyes open, and a camera crew's waiting for me to do something brilliant. And Snow's got PETA. Gale can think whatever he wants." In my new remake room in Special Defense, my prep team slaps me into my Mockingjay suit, arranges my hair, and applies minimal makeup before my coffee's even cooled. In 10 minutes, the cast and crew of the next propos are making the circuitous trek to the outside. I slurp my coffee as we travel, finding that the cream and sugar greatly enhance its flavor. As I knock back the dregs that have settled to the bottom of the cup, I feel a slight buzz start to run through my veins. After climbing a final ladder, Boggs hits a lever that opens a trap door. Fresh air rushes in. I take big gulps and for the first time allow myself to feel how much I hated the bunker. We emerge into the woods and my hands run through the leaves overhead. Some are just starting to turn.
"What day is it?" I ask no one in particular.
Boggs tells me September begins next week.
September?
That means Snow has had PETA in his clutches for 5, maybe 6 weeks. I examine a leaf on my palm and see I'm shaking. I can't will myself to stop. I blame the coffee and try to focus on slowing my breathing, which is far too rapid for my pace. Debris begins to litter the forest floor. We come to our first crater, 30 yards wide, and I can't tell how deep.
Very.
Boggs says anyone on the first 10 levels would likely have been killed. We skirt the pit and continue on.
"Can you rebuild it?" Gale asks. "Not any time soon. That one didn't get much. A few backup generators and a poultry farm," says Boggs.
We'll just seal it off.
The trees disappear as we enter the area inside the fence. The craters are ringed with a mixture of old and new rubble. Before the bombing, very little of the current 13 was above ground. A few guard stations, the training area. About a foot of the top floor of our building, where Buttercup's window jutted out, with several feet of steel on top of it. Even that was never meant to withstand more than a superficial attack.
"How much of an edge did the boy's warning give you?"
asks Haymitch.
"About 10 minutes before our own systems would have detected the missiles," says Boggs.
"But it did help, right?" I ask. I can't bear it if he says no.
"Absolutely," Boggs replies. "Civilian evacuation was completed. Seconds count when you're under attack. 10 minutes meant lives saved."
Prim, I think, and Gale. They were in the bunker only a couple of minutes before the first missile hit. PETA might have saved them. Add their names to the list of things I can never stop owing him for. Cressida has the idea to film me in front of the ruins of the old Justice Building, which is something of a joke since the Capitol's been using it as a backdrop for fake news broadcasts for years to show that the district no longer existed. Now, with the recent attack, the Justice Building sits about 10 yards away from the edge of a new crater. As we approach what used to be the grand entrance, Gale points out something, and the whole party slows down. I don't know what the problem is at first, and then I see the ground strewn with fresh pink and red roses.
"Don't touch them!" I yell.
"They're for me!" The sickeningly sweet smell hits my nose, and my heart begins to hammer against my chest. So I didn't imagine it. The rose on my dresser. Before me lies Snow's second delivery. Long-stemmed pink and red beauties, the very flowers that decorated the set where PETA and I performed our post-victory interview. Flowers not meant for one, but for a pair of lovers. I explain to the others as best I can. Upon inspection, they appear to be harmless, if genetically enhanced, flowers. 2 dozen roses, slightly wilted. Most likely dropped after the last bombing. A crew in special suits collects them and carts them away. I feel certain they will find nothing extraordinary in them, though. Snow knows exactly what he's doing to me. It's like having Cinna beaten to a pulp while I watch from my tribute tube, designed to unhinge me. Like then, I try to rally and fight back, but as Cressida gets Castor and Pollux in place, I feel my anxiety building. I'm so tired, so wired, and so unable to keep my mind on anything but PETA since I've seen the roses. The coffee was a huge mistake. What I didn't need was a stimulant. My body visibly shakes and I can't seem to catch my breath. After days in the bunker, I'm squinting no matter what direction I turn, and the light hurts. Even in the cool breeze, sweat trickles down my face.
"So what exactly do you need from me again?" I ask.
"Just a few quick lines that show you're alive and still fighting," says Cressida.
"Okay."
I take my position, and then I'm staring into the red light. Staring, staring. "I'm sorry, I've got nothing." Cressida walks up to me. "You feeling okay?" I nod. She pulls a small cloth from her pocket and blots my face. "How about we do the old Q&A thing?"
"Yeah, that would help, I think."
I cross my arms to hide the shaking, glance at Finnick, who gives me a thumbs up, but he's looking pretty shaky himself. Cressida's back in position now.
"So, Katniss, you've survived the Capitol bombing of 13. How did it compare with what you experienced on the ground in 8?
"We were so far underground this time, there was no real danger. 13's alive and well, and so am..." My voice cuts off in a dry, squeaking sound.
"Try the line again," says Cressida. "13's alive and well, and so am I."
I take a breath, trying to force air down into my diaphragm.
13's alive, and so...
No, that's wrong. I swear I can still smell those roses.
Katniss, just this one line, and you're done today. I promise, says Cressida. 13's alive and well, and so am I.
I swing my arms to loosen myself up, place my fists on my hips, then drop them to my sides. Saliva's filling my mouth at a ridiculous rate, and I feel vomit at the back of my throat. I swallow hard and open my lips so I can get the stupid line out and go hide in the woods, and... That's when I start crying. It's impossible to be the Mockingjay. Impossible to complete even this one sentence, because now I know that everything I say will be directly taken out on Peeta, result in his torture, but not his death, no, nothing so merciful as that. Snow will ensure that his life is much worse than death.
Cut, I hear Cressida say quietly.
What's wrong with her?
Plutarch says under his breath.
She's figured out how Snow's using Peeta, says Finnick.
There's something like a collective sigh of regret from the semicircle of people spread out before me. Because I know this now, because there will never be a way for me to not know this again. Because, beyond the military disadvantage losing a Mockingjay entails, I am broken. Several sets of arms would embrace me, but in the end, the only person I truly want to comfort me is Haymitch, because he loves Peeta too. I reach out for him and say something like his name, and he's there, holding me and patting my back.
It's okay. It'll be okay, sweetheart.
He sits me on a length of broken marble pillar and keeps an arm around me while I sob.
I can't do this anymore, I say.
I know, he says.
All I can think of is what he's going to do to Peeta, because I'm the Mockingjay.
I get out.
I know.
Haymitch's arm tightens around me.
Did you see how weird he acted? What are they doing to him?
I'm gasping for air between sobs, but I manage one last phrase.